Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. President Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria and the subsequent military action by Turkey, primarily against the Kurds, an American ally in the war against ISIS, has left the region in what has been described as chaos. Kurdish defenders could be massacred by Turkey. The Kurds have turned to Syrian dictator Assad and his Russian allies for help, and America's credibility could be severely damaged. Our guest today wrote about withdrawing U.S. troops from Syria almost a year ago and concluded it could have monumental effects. Joining us on today's program is retired Army Colonel Robert Hamilton, Associate Professor of Eurasian Studies at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Colonel Hamilton, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Nice to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Colonel Hamilton, you saw President Trump's order to withdraw troops from northern Syria coming. As I said, you wrote about it almost a year ago. He wanted to do it last year. So even though the timing may have been a surprise for many, the decision wasn't. What is the president's thinking on this?
Well, Scott, I think it was fairly easy to see coming because, as you noted, he did issue an order almost a year ago in December of 2018 after a call with President Erdogan from Turkey for the U.S. to withdraw troops from Syria. He issued it by tweet, and it said, essentially, ISIS is defeated. ISIS was the only reason we were in Syria in the first place, and therefore, I'm going to start the process of withdrawing the about 2,000 troops that serve in Syria. This tweet and the order that followed it was what prompted the resignation of Secretary of Defense Mattis and Special Envoy Brett McGurk, who was our envoy for the fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And then eventually what happened is the policy process. The professional national security community and the State Department, intelligence community, and the Defense Department was able to modify that decision and that order so that very few troops actually left Syria. And the U.S. stayed engaged in Syria and stayed partnering with the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is the coalition of Kurdish and Sunni Arab militias that has liberated all of northern and eastern Syria from ISIS.
So in that last part that you just mentioned, I want to make sure that we clarify that because it's been reported almost exclusively that the Kurds have been targeted, but the Kurds are just a portion of it.
Right, right. The SDF is somewhere between 60 and 70,000 fighters. Most of the leadership, the general officers, the military commanders are Kurds. But the fighters are a coalition, about 50% each, Kurds from northern Syria and then Sunni Arab tribes from the east bank of the Euphrates. So together, they fought together. They liberated Raqqa, which is in northern Syria, which was ISIS self-described capital inside of Syria. They did that in the summer and fall of 2017. And then the SDF fought its way down the east bank of the Euphrates all the way to the Iraqi border, defeated ISIS in that area, and liberated all of northern and eastern Syria from ISIS, which was the main reason for the United States to be in Syria in the first place, was the fight against ISIS.
But to be clear, Turkey and the Kurds have been traditional enemies.
That's exactly right. Turkey and the Kurds have long been enemies. Of course, the Kurds are spread over really four countries, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. They have a large presence in southeastern Turkey or in southern Turkey. And the Turkish government, President Erdogan specifically, I think, doesn't believe our assurances that the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish leadership of the Syrian Democratic Forces, is not just an adjunct of the PKK, which is the Turkish insurgent group, or I'm sorry, the Kurdish insurgent group inside of Turkey.
Mm-hmm. Which Turkey sees as a terrorist group.
Turkey designates them a terrorist group, and so they've argued, in fact, they call this operation in northern Syria that they're conducting now an anti-terrorist operation. When they announce casualties on the other side, they say they've killed X number of terrorists. Most of the world certainly doesn't see the SDF as terrorists, and much of the world doesn't necessarily designate the PKK as a terrorist group.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that even in the first few minutes that we're having our discussion that probably strikes a lot of people is there are a lot of players involved in this.
Yeah, this is a complicated war. And one of my colleagues at the Army War College, Larry Goodson, is in the middle of writing a book on how this could be the first great power war of the 21st century, because it's shifting coalitions of multiple different actors. You've got, on one hand, the Assad regime, Russia, who intervened in September of 2015 to prop the Assad regime up. It probably would have fallen by the end of that year had Russia not intervened. Iran, Lebanese Hezbollah, and then other Shia militia groups. So that's one kind of coalition that's fighting. Another side to it is the U.S.-led coalition designated Operation Inherent Resolve, which is actually responsible for both Iraq and Syria. That's the counter-ISIS coalition. Aligned with the U.S. coalition in Syria is the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces. And then there's some other smaller U.S.-backed opposition groups in other parts of Syria. Then you have players like Turkey, which is anti-Assad, but also anti-Kurd, and has frankly, in some ways, turned a blind eye to the ISIS threat in Syria, allowing ISIS fighters to cross over into Syria from Turkey because they see the Kurds as the greatest threat, Assad as the second greatest threat, and ISIS as a manageable problem. Then you have other Sunni-based opposition groups that are allied with, or that are in opposition to Assad, not necessarily allied with ISIS. And then you have Israel, which has intervened in Syria several times. Israel's main concern is that Iranian influence in Syria not rise to too high a level, and that Iranian forces are never on the Syrian-Israeli border.
When you wrote about this, you referred to something called the blob. Was that what you just described?
The blob is a term that was popular in the Obama administration, and it actually predates the Obama administration. But it's sort of a derogatory term for the professional national security and foreign policy community. And so President Obama's critique of the blob was it never met a military deployment it didn't like, and it never wanted to withdraw U.S. forces once they were deployed. And this is maybe one area where President Trump and President Obama agree, and that is that overseas deployments of U.S. military power not in defense of vital or at least very important national interests are probably not good policy.
All right. So let's get back to we've laid out the players. That phone call that President Trump had with Erdogan, I mean, none of us know for sure what was said during that phone call, but supposedly Erdogan said that, you know, we are going to move on the Kurds on northern Syria during that phone call. So what would have been said during that phone call that President Trump had to know that Turkey had this in mind if those U.S. troops were withdrawn?
Sure, I think that's right. And in the December 2018 call, so first, I would just say that this is something that Erdogan has been pushing for years, that the U.S. needs to withdraw from northern Syria, that Turkey has the right to a security zone along its border with Syria to make sure that Kurdish forces are not on the Syria-Turkey border. The United States, the Trump administration, and the Obama administration before that have pushed back on that by saying, we will manage the security problem on your southern border for you. We will ensure that there's no Kurdish fighters are not moving across the border and threatening Turkey. Essentially, we have positive control of the SDF, which is our partner force. We're in contact with their Kurdish leadership, and we're comfortable that they don't pose a threat to you. So we have been resisting Erdogan's push and Erdogan's calls for the United States to withdraw for years. It's inconceivable to me that the president didn't know in this call on the 6th of October what would result if he suddenly, which he did, agreed to withdraw U.S. forces from northern Syria. To be clear, we're only talking about a few hundred forces here in a couple of small towns, Manbij and Kobani, that were withdrawn, and they were withdrawn very quickly. I mean, now there are videos on the internet from Russia Today of Russian journalists walking around an abandoned military base, which is a propaganda gift to the Russians, only it's true, so it's not propaganda. It's true that the U.S. withdrew, and we withdrew precipitously, and we left the SDF and our partner force in northern Syria in a really difficult situation.
Getting back to a year ago when President Trump was contemplating this and Secretary Mattis resigned, there were other protests from the advisors in the administration. You had to think that part of it was that they said to the president that if the troops are taken out, even though it may be just a few hundred, that this is what's going to happen, and we are throwing our allies who fought alongside Americans against ISIS, that we're throwing them to the wolves. The president had to, you know, he had to be told that.
Yeah, he certainly knew. And again, like President Obama before him, I think President Trump questions this idea of credibility. Does credibility really matter? The Obama administration used to say we fetishized credibility. We can never withdraw from any conflict because it will damage U.S. credibility. So my argument in this case would be that it does matter. This credibility problem is going to be a big problem for us going forward for two reasons. One, partner forces have options. So the U.S. model kind of war fighting in contexts where we have important but not vital national interests at stake, basically this entire century, at least since 9/11, the model has been largely local ground forces, which in this case was the Syrian Democratic Forces, that do the fighting on the ground supported by U.S. Special Forces advisors, U.S. air power, U.S. intelligence, U.S. long-range fires, artillery fires, and then logistics. And what that does is it allows us to achieve national security interests without the deployment of significant U.S. ground forces. So if you think about what was achieved in northern and eastern Syria, the defeat of ISIS in that part of the country was done with 2,000 U.S. forces on the ground, which is a tiny number compared to the results achieved. So the SDF all along, and we know this, that the Russians have been telling the SDF all along, the Americans are not to be relied on. They will leave you when things get tough. The Russians have been trying for years to sort of peel the SDF off from us and telling them, we'll train you, we'll equip you, we'll partner with you. And the SDF leadership had been rebuffing those requests. So it's really going to be hard to see going forward how in a different context, another local partner force would agree to fight on behalf of or with the United States. So what that will do is it'll leave us in these type of wars to either deploy large numbers of U.S. ground forces at cost in funds and lives, or allow others to determine the outcome of the conflict.
I want to talk about credibility in just a moment because, again, that was something that you wrote about a year ago is U.S. credibility. But I want to get back to the simple math. You know, President Trump, right after ordering withdrawal, said we're talking about 50 troops. Well, there are more than 50 now. But as you said, at its height was 2,000 American troops. Why would that small number of troops keep Turkey from invading northern Syria?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it was even smaller in northern Syria. It really was in Kobani and Manbij, only, you know, a couple of hundred total. And so what they do is they serve as a deterrent because, first of all, Turkey's a NATO ally, right? So there's no reason that Turkey and the United States should find themselves in a shooting war with each other. Nevertheless, those U.S. outposts served as a confidence-building measure and also a deterrent for Turkey. Confidence-building in the sense that we've been in talks with the Turks for months now to do joint patrols out of Manbij so that they could have forces on the ground with the U.S. and we could patrol jointly in that area of the border so they could be sure that no Kurdish forces were crossing the border in either direction. They suddenly decided that that was not sufficient. In the call on the 6th of October, Erdogan told President Trump that we're going to execute this operation. We're going to come into northern Syria. We're going to create this buffer zone. And your forces are in the way. Previously, the president had said our forces and all of our military commanders all the way up and down the chain of command had said our forces are where they are for legitimate reasons and we'll defend ourselves. And we left it at that. For whatever reason, this time the president decided to withdraw.
Is there precedent for this? I mean, is there something we can compare it to in history?
That's a great question. I'm thinking.
Because I know that, you know, at the War College, you look at history, not just the past 10, 20 years, but look back hundreds of years in military actions. Is there any instance where you can think about where a leader that was told that there was possibility or a good possibility that an ally was going to be invaded, that we said, well, okay, we're moving out anyway?
Yeah, probably not this precipitously and not this unexpectedly. And again, so the idea of a gradual U.S. military withdrawal from northern and eastern Syria was not unexpected. One, because Erdogan had been pushing, like I said, for a long time. But even more importantly, from our perspective, was that President Trump had run on ending the endless wars.
So this is something that his words. Yeah. Tired of the American people are tired of these endless wars.
Yeah. So the idea of a gradual U.S. military withdrawal from northern and eastern Syria after ISIS had been defeated decisively in the sense that there was then no chance of ISIS regenerating and coming back, that idea was out there. But I you know, to be honest, can't think of a case where this quickly. I mean, if you look at the videos of Manbij, the U.S. base at Manbij, everything, we left everything there, but individual and crew serve weapons, vehicles, and critical pieces of military hardware. Everything else, the tents, the generators, the air conditioners, everything that's sort of not easily movable is there. And so this is fairly unprecedented, at least in my memory. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Hey, before we get back to our conversation, I want to remind you of an event coming up here at the WITF Public Media Center next week that I think that you would enjoy. WITF, in partnership with State Impact Pennsylvania, will host a local retro report discussion from invasive species to the Three Mile Island shutdown. Some of Pennsylvania's top environmental headlines have roots in historical events. Join me. I'll be hosting next Wednesday, a week from today, October 23rd, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. here at the WITF Public Media Center, as I host a retro report screening and panel discussion. We'll talk about climate change, invasive species, water quality, and more. Now, you have to register to attend, and I encourage you to do that. You learn a lot, and I think you enjoy the conversation. We will have a great panel discussion on hand, as well as previewing the retro report, which you can see on PBS. Register to attend at WITF.org/events. That is next Wednesday, a week from today, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. On today's program, we're getting the local perspective, even though it's a local perspective because the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, it's a worldwide perspective. Retired Army Colonel Robert Hamilton, he's an associate professor of Eurasian Studies at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, talking about what has occurred over the past week in northern Syria with Turkey invading, trying to establish a buffer zone, and the Russians being involved. Syria, President Assad being involved. As you heard just a few minutes ago, there are a lot of players in the region. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Colonel Hamilton, I wanted to talk a little bit more about credibility. You laid out a scenario, what the future could look like for American credibility after this move by the Trump administration. Are there any areas in particular where you could see this happening? I mean, for example, we still have troops, obviously, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. President Trump, when he campaigned, criticized President Obama for saying, okay, here's when we're leaving Iraq. As, you know, he said at the time, you don't tell your enemy when you're leaving. So do you see a scenario where our credibility, American credibility, that because of this has been harmed?
Sure. I think worldwide, even with maybe NATO allies, although there are treaty commitments to NATO that we didn't have with the SDF, but certainly in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places where the United States has fairly small military deployments that rely on partner forces, whether it's government partner forces or non-government partner forces, the idea that we could very suddenly leave a partner force alone to face adversaries on a battlefield, still not having met our political objectives, right? So, you know, you go to war for political reasons always. We achieved a military end state in northern and eastern Syria, or were very close to before this withdrawal, and that was the defeat of ISIS. But to keep ISIS from regenerating, and to you have to have a stable post-war scenario or environment in Syria, right? And so the U.S. was in a position to make sure that in that post-war Syria environment, our interests were represented, and that which the primary interest is that ISIS cannot use Syria as a breeding ground to attack us and our allies. So we've now, if we continue with this withdrawal, and we do withdraw completely from Syria, we're not really in a position to have a seat at the table in the post-war environment. For instance, Turkey is not that concerned about the ISIS threat. Turkey is much more concerned
which,
about...
Which, you know, just, I think, confuses a lot of people when you consider how brutal ISIS has been.
Right. ISIS has been brutal, but it hasn't attacked Turkey. And so, but Turkey sees the Kurds as a bigger threat, Assad, the Assad regime, as the number two threat in Syria, and ISIS as a longer term but manageable threat. So ceding that ground in northern and eastern Syria to Turkey is not good for our counter-ISIS campaign. In fact, there are already credible reports of ISIS detention centers where the SDF had been holding tens of thousands of ISIS fighters and families, either being bombed by Turkey or the SDF having to pull those fighters away from guarding the detention centers to fight the Turkish army and the detainees escaping. So there's already potentially hundreds or thousands of ISIS fighters and families now loose in that part of Syria.
So the next question is that hundreds or thousands, is that enough for ISIS to regroup and become a force again?
So ISIS had been defeated as a caliphate, so the physical caliphate, combined action by the U.S.-led coalition, the Assad regime, and the Russians in different parts of Syria had essentially taken all the territory that ISIS owned in Syria. ISIS was and probably is still in the process of transforming itself into a more traditional terrorist group, right, that doesn't declare a caliphate, act like a state and own territory, but just conducts attacks with small planning cells and leadership cells based in Syria, Iraq, or other places. So you don't necessarily need territory to do that. And a military solution may not be the best solution to take on that type of terrorist group. That's more an intelligence, law enforcement, maybe special operations if you use the military. It's a problem for those forces.
So to interrupt for just a second. So ISIS becomes more like Al-Qaeda.
Right. I think that's the road we were on before this Turkish incursion. But what the incursion has done now, it is destabilized northern Syria, and there certainly is going to be ungoverned space there that some of these ISIS fighters could congregate, collect, and operate in. And so we may now have to refight our way, or someone may have to refight their way through ISIS enclaves in northern and eastern Syria that didn't exist prior to the Turkish incursion.
So, as you just said, that ISIS was not your typical or traditional terrorist group. I mean, they had land. They had resources with oil that they sold around the world. Okay, they may not have those things now, but were their websites shut down where they recruited fighters? I read one story the other day that reminded Americans that several of the attacks that have occurred in this country, the shootings, the mass shootings, were inspired by ISIS. I mean, did those things shut down? Were with these ISIS fighters escaping and regrouping maybe, does that give them more power overseas?
It certainly gives them more power in Syria. It may give them a sanctuary from which to plan attacks overseas, yes. And to answer your question about are the websites shut down, no, not really. Of course, we try, but, internet and online presence is a hard enemy to fight. And so, yes, they're still present online. They still inspire people online. And there's still people that conduct attacks that I'm sure ISIS doesn't even know about beforehand, but they attribute to ISIS, and ISIS then claims them and takes credit for them. So they're defeated as a physical caliphate. They're not defeated as a terrorist threat.
In this area of northern Syria, what kind of energy resources are there? Oil resources, and are they valuable? Are they part of this?
So most of the oil and gas is farther south on the east bank of the Euphrates River, and so that's the area where the Sunni fighters who were part of the SDF, those are their areas. In fact, if you remember the February 2018 Russian Wagner Group private military company incursion it was an attempt to seize some of those oil fields that the SDF was sitting on. So they attacked the SDF. That's when the U.S. counterattacked and killed somewhere probably between 200 and 300 Russian mercenaries or private military contractors from the Wagner Group. So that fight was at least in part over oil infrastructure. But in northern Syria, there's very little of that. It's mostly in the southern part of the country, east of the Euphrates.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the Russians. This is one of the big conversations, as you mentioned, and events are happening so quickly here, mm-hmm. hour by hour. Yesterday, it only took the SDF, the Kurds, a day or so to, well, less, maybe a little more than that, to ask Assad for support. And Russians were then patrolling the streets. So there is a Russian presence now in that area. So what is the Russian role in all this?
So that in the kind of geopolitical, geostrategic sense, Russia intervened in Syria in 2015 for several reasons. One was to prop up Assad, who was an ally, and to keep the Assad regime from falling. Number two was to force the United States and sort of the West as a political entity to take Russia seriously as a geopolitical force, right? We had been able to mostly ignore Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Russia wanted to be back on the world stage, and Syria was a way to do that. And then the third reason was to push back against Russia, what Russia sees as a series of U.S.-inspired regime changes. They call them color revolutions, right? And they were in Georgia in 2003, in Ukraine in 2005, and then again in 2013-14. And they claim Libya was a color revolution, the fall of the Gaddafi regime, and they see the U.S. hand in Syria, too, in the opposition to Assad. And so Russia was drawing a line, in a sense, against this idea of U.S.-inspired democratic regime changes.
Even though the Soviet Union fell, what you just described sounds much like the Cold War. Proxy wars going on.
It sure does. It sure does. And I think we have to be comfortable with a context in which Russia is back as a geopolitical player, and it will use all of the instruments of power it has to defend what it sees as its interests. We don't consider those interests legitimate, but the truth is Russia's back. It's back in the Middle East. It's back in Eastern Europe in a way that it really hasn't been since the end of the Cold War.
You have a history with Russia.
I do. I had a couple of short stints working the Syria problem with the Russians on the other side, one in Geneva in the Syria Support Group in the summer of 2016, and then one at our headquarters in Kuwait, standing up and running what we call the Russian deconfliction cell in the summer and fall of 2017.
Okay, deconfliction, what's that? I mean, it sounds like a self-explanatory word, but still.
Well, there's actually there's political baggage to that word because Senator McCain, John McCain, when he was the chair of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate. He wrote into the National Defense Authorization Act language that said the United States military is prohibited from any sort of coordination or cooperation with the Russians. We knew that we needed to tell them where we were in Syria on the ground and know where they were. And so the term that everyone settled on was deconflict. We would deconflict our operations so we would not accidentally come into conflict.
Yeah.
But we could not coordinate or cooperate in Syria with the Russians.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask about Putin in just a moment, but let's take a phone call from Joe in Franklin County. Joe, you're on the air.
Great. Thanks, Scott.
Yes.
So my question, I hope I can make this clear, is about the decision-making process for engaging in Middle East affairs or withdrawing troops as what's happening. Doesn't the Defense Department have like this supercomputer that can project all these scenarios and probabilities for outcomes and then make a decision based on that? Or do you have this unilateral approach where the president makes decisions regardless of his input from other sources?
Hear
your response. Thanks.
Joe, thank you very much for your question. And again, this is something that you did address, Colonel. Talk about that. Not the computer part of it, but war games, scenarios.
Sure.
You do this all the time at the War College.
That's exactly right. Yeah, we have a building, Collins Hall, at the Army War College, the Center for Strategic Leadership, where we do computer-supported simulations. And the short answer to the question is, yes, we can simulate a lot of these things. A longer answer would say there's so many variables that enter into the equation that if you don't get the variables right, the computer's not going to give you the answer that a real-world scenario would give you. So I guess that's the first part of the answer. The second part is, presidents have the prerogative to make national security decisions and to ignore the advice of their advisors. I mean, that's... And as long as the decision is legal, which this one was, the departments, whatever the relevant executive branch agencies are required to carry it out. When President Trump tried to do it in December 18 is when you had the massive resignations and the national security bureaucracy was able to push back a little. This time, another person who was an impediment to this type of decision was John Bolton, who had already resigned by the time. So McMaster, Mattis, Bolton, everybody really who was in a position to push back hard against something like this was out of the administration by the time President Trump made this decision on the 6th of October.
Let's go to George in Mannheim. George, you're on the air.
Hi. My question has to do with our future relationship with Turkey. So despite the rhetoric coming out of the White House, we essentially turned our backs on our allies, the Kurds. But we have a longer allied relationship with Turkey through NATO. So the president withdrew the U.S. troops from northern Syria, and that was a wink and a nod to the Turks to conduct their military operations. But now we're imposing sanctions and we're condemning their action. And I'm curious about Colonel Hamilton's view on, you know, how our relationship with Turkey is already shaky and how this will affect it in the future. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, so the U.S.-Turkish bilateral relationship and the Turkey-NATO relationship have been difficult for at least the last several years. What an interesting story about Turkey and their involvement in Syria is in the early days of the war, they've been against Assad from the start of the war. When the Russians then deployed their military contingent in September 2015, within a few months, the Turks shot down a Russian plane because they claimed it violated their airspace. They also requested NATO send air defense batteries to be deployed along the Turkish-Syrian border to protect Turkey's airspace. NATO did that. Right, so NATO came through for its ally Turkey in the early days of the war when the Turks were adamantly against Assad and very dubious about the Russian military involvement. Since then, Russia has been able to sort of pull Turkey on side. And so Turkey is now part of this Astana process, which is a parallel conflict resolution process outside of the Geneva UN process, where the big players are the Russian government, the Assad regime, Turkey, and Iran. And so the Russians, in a large strategic sense, have pulled Turkey on their side. This Turkish incursion into northern Syria is complicating that relationship because the Russians have called it unacceptable. As you said, Scott, there are Russian troops now in Manbij between the Syrian government forces and the Turkish forces. So the Russians have a difficult balance to manage here.
One of our final questions, we're running out of time. Iran and Israel, where do they fit into all this?
Yeah, so Iran is one of the biggest supporters of the Assad regime. It has been for a long time. Iran provides forces along with the Russians, the Assad regime, and some of these other Shia militias on one side of the conflict. Israel and Iran are enemies.
I mean, mortal enemies.
Yeah, mortal enemies. There's no simpler way to say it. So the Israelis are adamant and determined that if and when the Assad regime gains control of the entire country, there are not Iranian proxy forces or Iranian actual forces on the ground along the Israeli border. They've shot down Iranian drones. They've attacked air bases from which the drones have been launched over into Israel. And so that's another sort of layer or facet to this conflict that's very, very delicate and could be destabilized quickly.
All right. So I know there are thousands of people, hundreds of people at least asking this question, but how's this all end up?
That's a great question. And again, my colleague Larry Goodson's writing a book on this.
he needs an ending for the book.
He does. I told you before we came on, Scott, I was in the parking lot checking my phone because this is happening. This is unfolding so fast since the Turkish incursion, that it is an hour-by-hour fight. But in the larger sense, whatever happens in northern Syria, there's two other parts of Syria that still are the outcomes yet to be determined. One is Idlib province, which is in the northwest of the country. That's where a lot of the ISIS remnants are. The remnants of the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria are there, and a bunch of other Sunni opposition groups. And so the Assad regime and the Russians would like to attack and take Idlib. The Turks do not want that because some of the groups that are inside of Idlib province are allied with Turkey. So that problem has to be resolved. There's still a U.S. contingent in a little garrison called Atanf that's down in the tri-border region in southern Syria, but on the Jordanian-Iraqi and Syrian borders. We're down there for really three reasons. There's a U.S.-backed group that we're protecting. There's an internally displaced persons camp in Rukban that we're concerned if we leave, we'll be bombed by the Russians and the Assad regime because they claim it harbors fighters. And then the third region, frankly, is to prevent Iranian influence because that's one of the ways Iranian fighters enter Syria is through the Iran-Iraq border. So that has to be resolved, too.
This is not an easy... you think back on World War II and the traditional wars that were fought. This is a lot different than those days. I want to thank our guest for being with us today, retired Army Colonel Robert Hamilton. He's an associate professor of Eurasian Studies at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Colonel Hamilton, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet presents its production of Once Upon a Rhyme at the Whitaker Center for Science and Arts in Harrisburg on October 26th and 27th. That's a week from this Saturday and Sunday. Using nursery rhymes put to dance, the production is widely anticipated. Quite frankly, every production by Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet is done with great skill and prowess. Dancers from all over the country travel to Carlisle to train 30 hours a week at CPYB. And we're joined and happy to have our guest today. Nick Ade is the CEO of the Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet. Kerry Burkett, you may recognize his voice. He's WITF on-air host, and he is the narrator for Once Upon a Rhyme, and also performers Ava Riddle and Jackson Martin. Welcome to all of you for being with us today.
Great. Thank you so much for having us.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk.com. WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Nick A., I want to ask you the big question. What's special about Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet?
Well, it really started with the vision of our founder, Marcia Dale Weary, changing lives through dance and being able to live up to the expectations and the values not only set up within the life lessons that classical ballet offers, but also Marcia's vision of being able to understand that classical ballet training offers you so many things, a sense of ownership of your work, a sense of leadership skills, a sense of communication skills, being able to understand what resilience and a work ethic is. And that's built into the training, not just the world-class syllabus and the curriculum of what she developed, but also the values that come with it. And that makes it truly a special place.
When you talk about the values, I mean, is that something that is specifically addressed, or is it just something that comes with the training and comes with the work? Because I mentioned 30 hours a week.
Right.
I mean, that's not just like going one night a week for an hour and a half, something like that.
Right.
This is hard work.
Yeah.
Values, when right up front, does a dancer know, you know, these are things that could be life-changing for you?
Absolutely. You know, it's drawn into the curriculum and it's built into it, but it's also something that we openly talk about. We talk about the choices that you make, in your work ethic, in being able to understand how you're going to get stronger. Do you try and cheat this step and make it a little bit easier for you to do, or do you just keep on doing it the most correct way and you eventually get stronger? Those are the choices that you have to make. There are no shortcuts in life, and we talk about those things constantly in classes and rehearsals so that they can apply that, whether it's math, whether it's academics can be applied to that. We instill that in the kids, so we're building great people, not just great dancers.
Mm-hmm. Kerry Burkett, here at WITF a few years ago, you produced a feature on Marcia Dale Weary, the founder,
right.
And we want to play just a snippet of this. Does it take any kind of setup?
Say that this was in 2011, and we were talking about a number of things, but one of the things, this is just a short excerpt where she talks about how she founded CPYB.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Greg.
As a little girl, Marcia Dale Weary loved the ballet and dreamed of becoming a dancer, but that dream would be denied.
My first dream was to be a dancer, but I started late. I started in time, but I didn't go to a real good ballet school. So when I went to New York, I had to start all over. So I found out it was too late to become a dancer.
But it was not too late for Marcia to develop her love and knowledge of dancing into becoming a teacher and starting what would become one of the finest schools for ballet in the country, the Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet.
I started teaching, I started helping my teacher, and then I started my own school. But I would go to New York every summer and then come back and teach. And then I start taking my children to New York, and I thought, this is not going to happen to my children. I want them to be able to go and really know ballet.
The school began in 1955 when Marcia, with her sister and father and others, began converting an old barn in Carlisle into a dance studio.
As soon as we laid so much floor, I would start teaching on a little bit of floor. I was so anxious, and so I just thought it was wonderful. When we finished the room, there was no bathroom, so the children had to walk up through the yard, past the grapevine where they would pick grapes. My mother would see them out the window and laugh, and then they would come back and pick some more grapes and eat them and then go, come back to their lessons. Let me see, I was probably 21 when my sister and I bought that property. But I had to work from not every day, from 9 in the morning, sometimes I wouldn't get home till 10 at night, every single day.
So, Carrie, just a great piece. That's just an excerpt from it. But yeah. What was your takeaway when you produced that piece?
Well, listening to it now, you can just hear her great love for what she did, her passion, her joy.
Even her disappointment when she said her dancing career wasn't to be.
You know, and Scott, I have heard from other dancers that it is possible to start late and still succeed. Some dancers have done that. But I think it was her destiny, really, to come and start this school, which has been such a tremendous gift to the region. And she instilled that love that she had into other students, many who went on to become and fulfill those dancer dreams that she had. I think this was what her purpose in life was.
Mm-hmm. So, Nick, how does a school like the Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet get a national reputation? Now, granted, it's been around, you heard, starting in 1955, mm-hmm. but you have to have some quality there,
yes.
and there has to be some word of mouth.
Yes.
How does a school like yours get the reputation that it does?
Well, yes, a lot of it has to do with word of mouth. And what ends up happening is that because of Marcia's training, starting in the barn, and the kids today, level 1A, you still have to come through the barn.
Is there a bathroom now?
Yes, there is.
Okay,
there are two bathrooms now.
Yeah.
you go ahead and you have this training, and all of a sudden people start to say, that's how I found out about CPYB. You know, you join a professional ballet company, you say, who's that person? They're enormously talented. And, you know, you go and you meet them and they say, well, I'm from CPYB, and you learn about Marcia. So it becomes a word of mouth. And she had generations of dancers that started to become professional dancers. Then all of a sudden, people start hearing about it. The summer program starts to grow. People end up wanting to stay. Nowadays, we have over 300 kids in our school, 40% of which relocate here from all across the country in order to be able to receive this world-class training.
Well, that's what I wanted to turn to our students that are with us today, Ava Riddle and Jackson Martin. Ava's from Sinking Spring, right?
In
Berks County, so you're not far away. But Jackson Martin is from the state of Washington.
Yes.
Where in Washington? Jackson?
I'm from the Tri-Cities area, so it's closer to the southeast side of Washington, but it's still very far away.
So why did you want to come to Central Pennsylvania, to the Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet?
It started out as a recommendation, and I saw the love for dance here, and I saw that it was really more of a family-friendly, and it really is a family here, and so everyone's kind and nice, and the training is amazing.
So your parents, obviously your family had a lot to do with this, to make the decision to move across the country to come to this school. I mean, did it take a lot of coaxing on your part to them, or what did they see?
My parents actually both still live in Washington State. I'm here by myself. I took the time to show to them that I could hold a job and afford to pay all my own bills and such, and so I work a part-time job and still have time to dance and pay all my bills and stuff. So
I'm sure you considered other schools.
Yes, I considered many other schools. And after a lot of consideration and talking to students who have danced here and at other schools, I decided this is probably the best training, and it has an amazing program.
Okay. So Ava, coming from Sinking Spring, I assume you still live at home in Sinking Spring, do you?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So tell me what makes a good ballet dancer, a great ballet dancer. I mean, someone was quick to point out to me when we were talking about doing this show is we're talking about athletes. We're talking about people who are not just performers but have fantastic athletic ability. What makes a successful dancer?
Well, Marcia always said that you had to be smart, and she would tell you that you were a smart dancer and you have to really just do it for yourself, and the teachers give you all the tools you need, but you have to be the one to apply them. You need to love it so much that nothing else really matters at the moment, and you're only focusing on the thing you love.
But when you say you have to be smart, why do you have to be smart?
Well, if you're not, you don't take the corrections and apply them how the teacher wants you to in order to get better. And you have to remember the corrections and keep them in the back of your mind to keep practicing every single class, because they're not going to get better in one class. It's a process over time that makes you a better dancer.
So your brain is a big part of what you're doing. It's not just something that is physical. It is mental as well. What do you enjoy most about ballet?
I think the performances. You go on stage and you kind of just see the audience, and all you want to do is perform for them and make them smile. And you never know how like their day is going or how you impact any of the audience members. So you just want to make their day, every single one of them.
Nick, Once Upon a Rhyme is the production that will be on stage October 26th and 27th. Tell us about it.
So it is developed by Carrie and also the choreographer Kellyanne Sloan. Marcia always believed in kids understanding and being kids for as long as possible. Nowadays, kids grow up so quickly. And so she always wanted to be able to make sure that kids understood how important reading and learning was. And so what ended up becoming of that was a ballet called Once Upon a Rhyme that is based on nursery rhymes, Mother Goose nursery rhymes. And it's about a schoolroom of children who their teacher, Mrs. Goose, starts telling them stories. And as she's telling them stories, Bo Peep walks into the room, and they go on an adventure to be able to go through different nursery rhymes like Jack and Jill, Miss Muffet, and are able to see the book.
Ava, what's your role?
I'm Little Miss Muffet.
I thought so. We have about 3 minutes left. Carrie, you were instrumental in writing a lot of these rhymes.
I wrote the narration. Kellyanne Sloan, the choreographer, wrote the story. It's her story that she put it together. I just came in later and turned the narration into a rhyming narration. So she's the one who developed this story.
You have an example right now.
I do. This is from the script. This is an encounter where Bo Peep and the children meet Humpty Dumpty, and they help him after they see his great fall. They help him back up, and they kind of mend him, and this is where this takes place. "You're very kind," said Humpty Dumpty. "I thank you, one and all, for helping me get back on my feet after my terrible fall. I see you're travelers in this land. I don't wish to delay you, but I'd like to help you if I can. Please, how can I repay you?" "I've lost my sheep," said Little Bo Peep. "They somehow went astray. Have you seen them wandering about? We know they came this way." "Now you mention, I did see two sheep before I took such a buffet. They were kept as pets by a spoiled little girl, the one called Little Miss Muffet. She'll be back soon when the bakers bring out their fresh hot cross buns. She loves sweets, that girl. If I ate like her, I'd end up weighing tons. The other sheep I haven't found, but I'll go and ask around. I'll do my best, and I won't rest till Bo Peep's sheep are found."
Thank you very much, Carrie. That is the best advertising you have for the program next week. Thank you very much, Carrie. So we have about a minute left. I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Nick, I know that there will be some people listening today after hearing Carrie's narration and hearing the conversation today who would like to see the show next week, Once Upon a Rhyme. How can they do that?
Best way is to go to cpyb.org and order your tickets through the website. You know, we're really looking forward to being able to entertain a lot of families and children over the next couple weeks.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one thing I didn't get to ask, Jackson, what part do you play in Once Upon a Rhyme?
I am one of Old King Cole's kingsmen, so I help try to put Humpty Dumpty together again.
See, it's the thing that strikes me is this is very cooperative. There's a lot going on here. I want to thank the four of you for being with us. Nick Aide is the CEO of the Central Pennsylvania Youth Ballet. Carrie Burkett, you hear her on WITF, and is the narrator for Once Upon a Rhyme. Performers Ava Riddle and Jackson Martin, again, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. We will be talking about domestic violence. Also, a program for cities and some tax breaks, and trying to help cities get back on their feet. That's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in.